Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the $5 billion election underway, which if you factor in all of the local, state and federal elections, will likely end up being closer to a $10 billion spending spree. And speak with Wendell Potter, the co-author of a new book, Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. With the growing likelihood that Donald Trump will win big in tomorrow's primaries and move closer to the magic 1237 delegate number, we will discuss how the Republican money machine will coalesce around him in spite of his claim to not take special interest money and only spend his own. And we'll also discuss the positive contribution of Bernie Sanders, whose campaign has been well funded by small donors and could serve as a future model if the Democrats win the White House and Senate and can overturn Citizens United with a new Supreme Court. Then we will speak with Thomas Frank, the author of What's the Matter with Kansas and Pity the Billionaire, the Hard Time Swindle and Unlikely Comeback of the Right, and his latest book just out, Listen Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. He joins us to discuss why, in spite of their venom spewed at Barack Obama, the uber-rich 1% have done very well under his presidency, having gotten what they want, more immigration, trade deals, and continued defense spending, which ironically might be threatened by a President Trump. We will look into why the Party of the People has become captured by a globalist-minded elite, both economically and culturally, while the Republican Party under Trump could become the party of the working class. And joining us now is Wendell Potter, who, after a long career in the for-profit health industry as chief corporate spokesman at Cigna Corporation and as head of corporate communications at Humana Inc., became a senior analyst on healthcare at the Center for Public Integrity. His new book is Obamacare, What's in It for Me, What Everyone Needs to Know About the Affordable Care Act. And his latest book just out is Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wendell Potter.
Ian, thank you very much.
And we are facing a $5 billion election this year. And of course, ironically, the only people who benefit from our broken political system and this sort of game show democracy we have that's now morphed into a reality show democracy are the big media monopolies who make a fortune out of all the political advertising because that's how people get their information. So it's very unlikely that the beneficiaries of our broken system, the mainstream media, are going to really call for its reform. So I guess it's down to people like you, Wendell, and your co-author, Nick Penniman.
Well, you know, thank you, Ian. And as a matter of fact, it's when you include all of the elections around the country this November, between this, you know, including the primaries and the November elections all across the country at all levels, we're expecting probably $10 billion to be spent on campaigns. So that just gives you an idea of just the scope of the spending, which is far, far more than we've ever spent before. It just keeps going up every election cycle. And you're right, the media conglomerates benefit more than anybody else from this outrageous spending. But we do believe that we're seeing the beginning of a rebellion, at least the awareness of the fact that all this money that's being raised and spent is resulting in a rigged government and a rigged economy.
And do you see any difference, though, with what's happening with Bernie Sanders, who's raising funds from regular folks, the average of which is $27, and Donald Trump, who has managed to get enormous amount of free advertising and is not really spending, he's saying he's only going to spend his own money, but he's not really spending very much of it. I guess that would change if he became the candidate. But do you see any change in this year's election?
I do. In fact, in many ways, it's despite the fact that we're spending so much, I think this could be a year of a turning point. It has been very encouraging to see the amount of money that Bernie has been able to raise through hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of donations. Very small. I think the average donation is $27, and it has at times he's raised more money than Hillary Clinton. So it's just phenomenal what he's been able to do. That has been encouraging to a lot of candidates. I've talked to people who are running for Congress and at other levels of political elections, and they're asking, can you know, is there something that I could do to emulate that? So I think that is indeed a very, very big positive this year. And as far as Donald Trump is concerned, yes, he has. There's a lesson learned there too. If you can say something provocative day in and day out, the media can't get enough of you. So yes, he has gotten so much of his exposure through earned media, as it's called, free media, and hasn't had to spend a whole lot of his campaign cash so far.
And again, I'm speaking with Wendell Potter, who, after a long career in the for-profit health industry, is chief corporate spokesman at Cigna Corporation and as head of corporate communications at Humana, Inc., became a senior analyst on healthcare at the Center for Public Integrity. And his latest book just out is Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. So given that both Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders have made the point that if they get elected, the first thing they're going to do is change the Supreme Court, which, as you know, is hanging in the balance now. There is a nominee that President Obama's put forth who the Republicans refused to vote on. But is that, again, I'm sort of looking for the positive here because it is so depressing and the effect of Citizens United has been so detrimental to our politics. It's become so glaringly clear that that's the case. Do you think that that's what it will take? And is it that simple that all you'd have to do is elect either Bernie or Hillary and a new appointee on the Supreme Court will change the majority and they'll just throw this damn thing out?
Well, two things here. One, I think it's very important to consider as you're voting that the Supreme Court, the majority will be determined by who is elected. We currently have 4-4 because of Justice Scalia's death. And if you have a Democrat, Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton, yes, they will appoint someone, I'm confident, who will look at cases as they come forward that can be used to undo much of what we have seen. The consequences of Citizens United. So I think that's entirely possible and likely if one of them is elected. The other thing to keep in mind, however, is that as much of an overreach as that Supreme Court decision was in Citizens United, and in fact it has opened the floodgates for a lot of money that just has been pouring into super PACs and organizations that really don't have to report who their donors are, that's bad. But there are other aspects of big money in politics that can be addressed that really doesn't require a Supreme Court decision. In fact, my co-author Nick Penman and I believe that probably about 75% of the problems that could be addressed and resolved by legislation at various levels of government. It doesn't require the Supreme Court. And here we're talking about lobbying reform and ethics reform and other things that can be done to reduce the effect of all this money that's being spent on elections.
But shortly after Citizens United, the Congress voted on the Disclose Act. And you might recall that Justice Kennedy, who wrote the Citizens United opinion over the objections of Justice Stevens, had this extraordinarily naive notion that somehow Citizens United would lead to disclosure, which it hasn't.
Right.
It's gone the opposite direction. They can hide it under these IRS 501c4 fictions that they create. So the Disclose Act came out, and of course it was killed by the Republicans. So how would you ever get that important change short of overturning the Citizens United itself?
Well, keep in mind that there's a good chance that the Senate could change hands this next year, and that would lead to the possibility of that being elected. One of the biggest stumbling blocks in the Congress for reform is Mitch McConnell, who is the Senate Majority Leader. And if the Democrats were to regain control of the Senate again, I think the Disclose Act would be reintroduced and would have a better chance of passing. Of course, chances are we will probably still have a Republican House, but there are many Republicans who are also concerned about the effect of big money in politics, as we make very clear in Nation on the Take, our new book. We've talked to many Republicans who are just as fed up as Democrats are. So I think there is really good reason to hope that we can get things accomplished. And keep in mind, Ian, it's not just at the federal level that we're so focused on that because of the presidential campaign, but a lot is going on at the state level. In fact, there are those in California who are gathering signatures to have a ballot this coming November that would address money in politics. And you'll see the same thing in a number of states. So I think there are at least five others that are likely to be voting on good government initiatives in one form or another. And many states already have done it. The state of South Carolina, for example, a few years ago enacted a bill that makes it illegal for lobbyists to make contributions to state legislative candidates. That's very important. We think that can serve as a model for other states as well as Washington. A lot of cities around the country are passing initiatives that are creating citizen-funded elections, and we're hopeful that will be replicated across the country. Just this past year, voters in Seattle passed a measure that creates a system of citizen funding or public funding. So we're seeing a lot that's going on. We just recognize it probably will start first at the local and state levels and then bubble up to the national level.
And Wendell Potter, I would think that politicians themselves, particularly in the Congress and in the House and Senate, they can't like doing this irksome sort of deed every day. I mean, this system has turned our legislators into telemarketers, where they spend hours and hours on the telephone asking for money. It's a humiliating and disgusting thing to do in the first place. So, you know, when you say you talk to these people, do they ever say that this really rots their soul?
Oh, it does. In fact, Congressman Steve Israel from New York has talked about it quite a bit. He's retiring this year. He just was fed up, and he's the Democrat who is head of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. So he's the guy responsible for raising most of the money for congressional candidates. He's just sick of it, and he says, I think he counted up over his 15 years in Congress, he clocked about 4,200 hours of what's referred to as call time. Just a few years ago, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee distributed a memo to incoming members of Congress, the freshman class, suggesting how they should spend their time every day while they're in Washington. And when you look at it, what they're recommending is that they spend at least 50% of their time every single day dialing for dollars. And what you see in practice is that members of Congress leave their offices on Capitol Hill and they walk a few blocks to party offices, and they sit in a cubicle, and as you said, they become telemarketers. They dial for dollars, and they're calling, of course, people who have the potential to write big checks. They're not calling average folks, that's how they raise money for their campaigns largely. They hate it. They do hate it, and we're seeing that more and more. A lot of people are leaving Congress because of they're just disgusted with what has happened and how they have to spend their time. They can't spend time on the people's business. They don't have enough time reading bills or attending and chairing committee hearings. It is just the people would be. I think Americans would be astonished with what has happened to our democracy.
And in terms of tomorrow's elections in five states, Wendell Potter, obviously the elections are shaping up where tomorrow could well decide that it may narrow the field to Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. But again, the others are spending money like crazy on negative advertising. But how do you see it if Trump becomes the candidate? I imagine on the Democratic side, there'll be all kinds of advertisements warning about the that the sky will fall under Donald Trump. And on the Republican side, as we mentioned earlier, would he therefore sort of forget about putting his own money into the campaign, which is largely, I think, a lie? I don't think he's putting much in himself.
Right.
But I imagine, you know, as they sort of coalesce around him and basically, I think Lindsey Graham who said the choice between Trump and Cruz is a choice between being shot and being poisoned. So assuming they drink the poison or take the bullet, what's your sense
Exactly right. It's an incredible situation. And I live in Pennsylvania, one of the states that will be voting on Tuesday, tomorrow, for presidential, you know, for the candidates. And we are seeing a lot of the campaigns here, including some that Hillary Clinton has on that is really attacking Donald Trump more than Bernie Sanders. I think that if Donald Trump is the nominee, that yes, after the party convention, I'm sure you'll see a lot of money flooding in to support him, even though a lot of Republicans are trying to distance themselves from him. There'll still be a lot of money that will flow into his campaign, largely though from contributors who would vote for almost anyone instead of Hillary Clinton. But so yes, he has not. You're right. He has not really spent a lot of his own money, even though he said that. And as you said earlier, he's gotten as far as he has largely because of the media's attention.
So when you say, Wendell Potter, in your new book, Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It, that American democracy has become coin-operated, others I've spoken to have described Washington, D.C. as Nigeria on the Potomac. And the corruption that they talk about, it's manifest, for example, in real estate prices. You know, there's so much money sloshing around because of all the lobbyists, et cetera. But the money doesn't just go to politicians. And we're learning, for example, about Trump's new campaign guy, Manafort, has a big PR firm, and he's been representing every sleazebag dictator you can imagine, and obviously getting paid a lot of money. But then you have the contractors who are being paid a fortune in defense and intelligence, et cetera. So it seems to be that because we have a money-driven system, it's corrupted not just our politicians, but it's corrupted the government itself.
Right. It has. It has corrupted the government. And it is what our founding fathers feared, exactly what is unfolding now, is we've reached the point that it's very hard to get anything passed through Congress or in the states, for that matter, that really are for the common good. Most of the legislation that's passed, certainly in Washington, has to be approved first and foremost by the special interests. They largely write the legislation these days. So it has become a government for the special interest, not average Americans. And I've seen this change. I was a reporter in Congress many years ago, and the place sort of looks the same around the Capitol. The buildings are largely the same. But inside those buildings is an entirely different world. The way they spend their time and the constant quest for money, and as I said earlier, the people they're soliciting money from and are willing to write the big checks are special interests who have an agenda, and they're expecting something from those checks.
But as long as they are running the show and they're taking care of themselves and their clients, the lobbyists, and their clients, of course, are the big corporations and the rich and powerful in this country, it's logical that the average people are getting shortchanged. So
Right. When
Bernie Sanders talks about a revolution, it seems to me that changing this money-driven system is at the heart of the revolution. And frankly, that's pretty much what Bernie's refrain has been. Do you accept that idea that you really can't take on reforming our government until you deal with this issue first?
Oh, absolutely. There's nothing that can be done on any issue that will really be done for the benefit of the country, of the common good for individual and average Americans until we address this. The Affordable Care Act that we wound up with does some good, but it first and foremost was written to benefit the special interests. The same can be said of the Dodd-Frank Act, which supposedly and has to a certain extent changed the way banks are regulated. But much of that was written by banking lobbyists. So yeah, that's the way it has developed in this country, and we've got to do something about money in politics, or we'll never get the kinds of reforms in other areas of our society and our culture and our economy that we really need.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Wendell Potter, and I thank you for your new book, Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. It's a necessary primer for our audience to take on this issue and turn the country around.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Wendell Potter, who, after a long career in the for-profit health industry as the chief corporate spokesman at Cigna Corporation and as head of corporate communications at Humana Inc., is now a senior analyst on healthcare at the Center for Public Integrity. And his latest book just out is Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with Thomas Frank, the author of the new book, Listen Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People.
It's the money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Thomas Frank, the author of The Wrecking Crew, What's the Matter with Kansas, One Market Under God, and Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Time Swindle and Unlikely Comeback of the Right. A former opinion columnist for The Wall Street Journal, Thomas Frank is the founding editor of The Baffler and a monthly columnist for Harper's. And his latest book just out is Listen Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Frank.
It's my pleasure, Ian.
And, of course, the Party of the People last week, New York's results were pretty resounding. Win for Hillary Clinton, and then tomorrow there'll be five states voting, and Hillary Clinton's expected to do well and get closer to the magic number for the nomination, as is the case on the other side with Donald Trump. But would that mean then, if we are shaping up for a Hillary Clinton-Donald Trump presidential race, would that mean that all of what Bernie Sanders has done to push her to the left, all of the kids that he's brought in and all the passions and idealism that he's brought in will be out the window because everybody will be so alarmed at a Trump presidency? Hillary won't, her feet won't be kept to the fire, particularly on Wall Street, etc.
Yeah.
And people will be voting simply to stop Trump, and that might well be enough to get the kids back to vote. And Hillary may even get a lot of Republicans.
Well, hell, that's what this is all about. That's the two-party system. That is the sort of the ugly beauty of this monopoly. You're supposed to get in, this two-party monopoly. You're supposed to get very enthusiastic about it, because you're so frightened by the other side. Now, in this case, it seems what Trump has said seems a little more frightening than on other occasions, because the bigotry and the intolerance seems to be right out in the open this time, rather than hinted at or anything like that. And I think that's, yeah, will Hillary, no, of course Hillary's not going to, you know, she adopted these leftist positions to head off Bernie Sanders. And now she goes back to the right, of course. That's what they do. That's how the game is played.
So when was the last time, then, that an election was won or run on the basis that the person that you're voting for is really somebody you want to vote for, as opposed to they're better than the other guy or girl?
You know, that's a good question, because this is going to be an unusual election in the sense that both of the major party leaders are both major party figureheads are unpopular, you know, and so unpopular people have captured or look like they're on the road to capturing the two major party nominations. But I think that's kind of unusual. I think about 2008, which is, we all thought was such a big deal election at the time, where Barack Obama had this kind of hope and enthusiasm behind him. And John McCain was not a particularly bad, as Republicans go, he was a pretty likable one. You know, better than a lot of other Republicans have been. Mitt Romney was in 2012. Well, in 2012, you started inching towards where we're at today. But 2008, that was a very hopeful time.
Well, I
feel like I'm bad. I'm giving short shrift to the people who really are enthusiastic about these two candidates. You know, you look at Trump's rallies, and you do have these enormous crowds turning out for him. And at the same time, I have been to Hillary Clinton events that are filled with Hillary enthusiasts, and they really like her. They think she's the greatest thing in the world. And so let's not forget those people. I mean, that's kind of interesting, too.
Well, my feeling is that we've had for some time a kind of game show democracy. And with the arrival of Donald Trump, it's morphed into a reality show democracy.
Yeah.
And now my sense is that maybe what we're witnessing here is more to do with, you know, the Mets versus the Oakland A's or whatever. You know, is it more tribal? Is it more about the team, your side winning, than a deep and passionate identification with the political platform of the candidate?
Well, you know, on the one hand, that's obviously right. Look, Trump is, both of these people, both Trump and Hillary, prevailed largely because they're well-known celebrity figures. You know, you look at the reasons why Hillary has been able to overcome Bernie Sanders, and it's largely because she's a very well-known figure. You know, she's been around for decades. Everybody knows who she is. And a lot of people are very fond of her. To a lot of other people, she's made lots of promises to them. You know, they know what to expect. Everybody here in Washington, if Hillary's elected president, I expect she will be, everybody gets to move up a notch. You know, everybody in the entire vast Democratic machinery of this town. And they're all really, really excited about that. Now, if it was Bernie Sanders as the nominee, I mean, all bets are off. You know, they have no idea who this guy is or what he represents or who is going to get what job if Bernie Sanders was the nominee. And Trump is a pure, celebrity. Sort of celebrity figure. Although the Trump does have these issues, you know, that people are excited about. In particular, this business about trade—it's very interesting. It's an issue that Democrats have been talking big about for years and haven't done anything about. I mean, Barack Obama in 2008 promised to renegotiate NAFTA and didn't do it. Wasn't really interested in it, and in fact went precisely in the opposite direction and gave us the Trans-Pacific Partnership instead. And so there is that. I mean, whether or not Trump will actually, you know, were Trump to be elected president, which just, I mean, what a chilling thought, you know. But were that to happen, do you think he would actually do anything about it? I don't know. I doubt it.
And again, I'm speaking with Thomas Frank, the author of The Wrecking Crew, What's the Matter with Kansas, One Market Under God, and Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Time Swindle and Unlikely Comeback of the Right. He's a former opinion columnist for The Wall Street Journal and is the founding editor of The Baffler and a monthly columnist for Harper's. His latest book just out is Listen, Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. But just following on from what you've just said, though, Thomas Frank, it would seem to me that this year, in spite of the results, or the what seems to be the results, you know, and we'll have more clarity tomorrow night, but still it's looking as though it's going to become a Hillary and versus Trump situation. And what you can at least say is that whereas Hillary Clinton is a status quo politician, Donald Trump is not. And the rise and success of Bernie Sanders has also indicated that people, or a lot of people out there, don't want business as usual. They don't want the system improved or tinkered with. They want the system changed. And that's what Trump is also promising. So what happens then to that energy, that movement, that desire for change? And after all, the biggest constituency in the United States are not Democrats and Republicans, but independents. So How do you see the future?
There's going to be, I think, 4 years from now. Well, first of all, look at what Hillary Clinton, who's likely going to be the next president, look at what Hillary Clinton is promising. This is, she's running strictly as a candidate of complacency. Nothing's wrong. You know, there is no real emergency. Little tinkering, as you said, tinkering around the edges will be, make everything fine. You know, put the experts in charge back in Washington, and they'll do everything right. You know, nothing to worry about. It's Barack Obama's third term. And remember, all of this started with such great hope and fanfare in 2009. I like to remind listeners of the title of Jonathan Alter's second book about the Obama presidency, which was The Center Holds. You know, forget hope and change, The Center Holds. I mean, he's essentially a conservative candidate, and so is Hillary Clinton. And what that suggests to me is that everything is going to continue the way it has been. Inequality will get worse. All the problems that are plaguing middle America, the decline of the middle class, which is just such a shocking development, that will continue. Hillary Clinton is, I was watching her last debate with Bernie Sanders, and she's openly saying, you know, what is her campaign about? It's about knocking down the barriers to people getting ahead. It's not about people who can't get ahead. It's not about, you know, it's about finding the talented people. It's classic meritocracy. That's what we're voting for, more of that stuff, you know, more charter schools, hooray. And everything that we complain about today is going to get worse, and 4 years from now you are going to have another Bernie Sanders campaign, but it'll be some, you know, hopefully it'll be someone who's a better-known figure. And you'll have another Donald Trump. You know, this is going to continue. And let's just hope that that we get somebody in the White House who knows how to deal with the problem rather than somebody like Trump, who's this kind of, you know, frightening Huey Long sort of figure.
But still, when you mentioned, for example, Alter's book, The Center Holds, I assume what he was referring to was against the assault from the right.
And, yeah, that's right.
And that is a relentless fact in American politics. I mean, the minority party, because of the skill of the Karl Roves and ALEC and other organizations, they went after the states. They've got most of the governorships, most of the states. They were able to, in 2010, after this big sweep by Obama, 2 years later, boom, they, on a census year, they win all these state houses.
No, I of course. They play the game. They play it well. Yeah. It doesn't, I mean, there's no reason the Democrats can't play that game as well. You know, it's silly to complain about one side being really good at the game. We can all see what they're doing. Why isn't the other side doing it as well? You know, it's a good question.
Right. Well, let me offer an answer.
one of the things I wondered about when I was writing Listen, Liberal. Why the hell don't the liberals also do it?
Right. Well, let me offer an answer then. My sense is that the problem that the liberals have and the Democrats have is they, unlike the Republicans who get their money from the Chamber of Commerce and the Koch brothers and all of the oligarchs, and that's a natural fit for them, the Democrats essentially get their money from the same people, but they get their votes from regular working class and middle class Americans.
Yeah.
So the game seems to be about how do you sort of, you know, dampen the pain and you know, repackage the same product to make it feel more user-friendly than the right wing, which is really about, you know, we're just going to take care of our own. And if you're stupid enough to vote for us, terrific, you know.
Yeah. Well, I'm fascinated by the sort of the problem of, you know, the Democrats' love of consensus, which is what this is, that they have this bottomless faith that the other side is going to play fair and that they're going to come back to the middle and they're going to shake hands over it and they're going to get a deal. Think of Barack Obama pining for the grand bargain, or Bill Clinton before him, you know, making his deals with Newt Gingrich. You know, Tom DeLay wrote a memoir about, you know, remember Tom DeLay? I mean, one, when you talk about people that play politics in this kind of, you know, rough and tumble way, he was sort of the master of it, although that's not the right word for a guy like him. But he wrote a memoir about it, and he said, you know, we knew that Clinton would always do the same thing. He'd come to the center with his hand extended. And so we just kept moving the center to the right, kept pulling farther and farther to the right. The reason that the Republicans do this is because it works. And the question is, why do the Democrats act the way they do? You know, it's just when you've only got two parties, it's just the most basic kind of game theory, you know. The question is, why do the Democrats do what they do? And this was, you know, one of the sort of animating themes of Listen Liberal. And what I finally concluded is that it is a product of the group that Democrats are in love with, the group that they are all drawn from, the group that they fundraise among, and that's the professional class. That's, you know, who they come from. When I described Hillary Clinton in meritocracy a minute ago, that's, she really believes that because that's who she is. She is a consummate professional, a lawyer, went to Yale Law School, used to be very proud of herself for being, you know, the best lawyer in Arkansas or whatever it was, you know. And among this sort of cohort that the entire Democratic establishment is not only drawn from, but looks to as their A number one constituency, as well as the obvious, the winners in history itself, this group adores the idea of consensus and deeply mistrusts the idea of partisanship. This is, you know, this is like hardwired into the professional mind. And so they come to Washington, they always behave in exactly the same way. They never seem to be able to learn the obvious lesson. Oh, I take it back. Barack Obama has learned it now. It's a little too late, you know. He would actually be, if Barack Obama was starting his presidency right now, he would probably be really awesome. He would do a great job. But he didn't learn that lesson until it was too late, is my feeling. But this is they come to Washington and they make the same mistake again and again and again. And you watch, Hillary Clinton will do it as well.
Well, but so Thomas Frank, does that explain why when Bill Clinton was elected, he got the trifecta, or the Democrats got the trifecta, the White House, the Senate, and the House? They had all three branches of government. And from 92 to 94, they enjoyed that. But in 94, they got wiped out by Newt Gingrich's contract on America.
Yeah.
So, and the same thing happened with Obama. From 2008, he won. He had all three branches under Democratic control, got nothing or little done. And 2 years later, in 2010, Karl Rove and all the big money turned the tables, and it's been gridlock ever since. So why is it that when the Democrats control all three branches of government, they essentially get nothing done?
Oh, Clinton got things done. He got several big things done. He got... there's three off the top of my head here.
In those 2 years?
Yeah, in the first 2 years. He got NAFTA, he got bank deregulation, and he got the crime bill in 94. And all three of them were harmful to his own base. You know, it was just, this is what they do. They get into office and they immediately, whack their own base over the head with a club, you know, and reach out to Wall Street. And that's what Clinton did. Remember what he failed to do. Remember, he was promising the great national health care system, and Hillary was the point man on that, remember, and he failed to do that. Mm. He couldn't get anywhere with that. It was just, incredible disaster. But he embarked on his sort of austerity policy. He gave up on the idea of, rebuilding infrastructure almost immediately when he became president, and instead embarked on austerity. It was not a good way to – I mean, these were great things to do if what you're trying to do is prove that you can be as good a Republican as the Republicans. These are great things to do. If you're trying to get your base, excited and make them pleased that they elected you president, these are exactly the wrong thing to do.
Right. Well, that's the neoliberal trap or con, which is you invert freedom for sacrifice.
Yeah.
But the sacrifice, of course, only ends up rewarding the oligarchs. But at the end of the day, it seems that when you talk about meritocracy, it's a meritocracy versus an oligarchy.
Yes, that's right.
That's our choice.
That's right. And then that's exactly what it is.
Right, and on the course, George W. Bush was a perfect example of a representative of the oligarchs, since he was all about those that inherit, and was a part of a political dynasty that's essentially a form of American oligarchy. Let's continue the conversation, Thomas Frank. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment. Continue the conversation with Thomas Frank.
That we learned, is it just a premonition? Could we really get ourselves both burned? I've been sent here on a mission to find what we agree upon. We don't agree about September. Could we agree on the enough? Oh, I do believe if you don't like things you leave for someplace you've never gone before.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And we're continuing the conversation with Thomas Frank, the author of The Wrecking Crew, What's the Matter with Kansas, One Market Under God, and Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Time Swindle and Unlikely Comeback of the Right. He's a former opinion columnist for The Wall Street Journal and the founding editor of The Baffler and a monthly columnist for Harper's. And his latest book just out is Listen, Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. So at the risk of depressing the hell out of our audience, Thomas Frank, let me ask you this. Do you think that the good news, as opposed to the relentless bad news, could be that at the very least, if Hillary Clinton becomes president, there is an opportunity, and particularly if the down ticket damage that they expect Donald Trump to do would mean that the Democrats could take back the Senate, could they put in a Supreme Court justice who would give them the majority to overturn Citizens United? And I don't know whether you can redo the damage done to the Voting Rights Act. I think some of that would have to be done by Congress, but maybe there are ways to at least mitigate the damage in terms of voter suppression, which has clearly been enabled by the Supreme Court for the Republicans.
Yeah. Well, if Hillary Clinton wins, and I expect she will, yes, they will, of course, be able to name the Supreme Court justice. Because what are the Republicans going to do? Delay for 4 years? No. What they're doing is already unconscionable. But it will immediately vanish when she's inaugurated as president. And they'll have to deal with whoever she nominates. There's no doubt about that. Whether or not that means that they will overturn Citizens United is a different question. I haven't looked at it, and I don't know. I don't know how it will come down. Citizens United is a you know, is a remarkable opinion. Have you ever read the opinion? It has these outrageous claims written into it, claims that everybody knows are false, as part of the finding, you know, as part of the what the judge has determined. And one of them was that just because, you know, interests give money to a candidate does not mean that the candidate is, you know, that there's any appearance of corruption, which is, you know, a remarkable thing to say. And interestingly enough, this is what the Hillary people are saying right now. They're saying the same thing. Glenn Greenwald wrote this great article pointing this out. I'm so grateful to him. That, you know, pointing out that what the Hillary supporters are saying about her, you know, the speeches that she gives to various Wall Street banks and the exorbitant honorariums she gets for this, that this is, you know, and then they say, well, there's no corruption there just because she gets paid by these guys. There's not even any appearance of corruption. That this is essentially the same reasoning as Citizens United. I have no idea whether they'll be able to overturn that. I don't remember if that was a close decision or do you remember?
Yeah, it was a 5-4. Yeah,
it was a 5-4. Well, then maybe they will. Kennedy, wouldn't that be great?
Kennedy was the key to it. He wrote the opinion, and Stevens was in dissent, and very passionate dissent. He, of course, being a Republican appointee. No, you know, that's the part that I think that was the oligarch's naked hand in that ruling, and then so you ask yourself, well, what can the meritocracy do to bring it back? But
the meritocracy is very, very, very good at certain things, very liberal on certain things, but not so liberal on others. You know, ultimately the point that I'm making in Listen Liberal is that it's more than money. You know, I've written about the money in politics for years, and I'm sick of writing about it. You know, the story is bigger and vaster and more complicated than anybody knows. You know, it goes very deep, goes on and on and on and on. You know, there's all of these different ways that money intervenes in politics. However, there's also just the simple matter of parties and interest groups and who the parties serve and who they don't care about. It's not a completely unrelated question. I mean, the two problems are intermingled in, you know, all sorts of ways. But just overturning Citizens United is not going to be the thing that restores democracy in this country. There's got to be a lot more than that. You know what I would like? Well, I should shut up. I should shut my mouth.
No. What would you like? Go ahead.
I'd like to see the two-party monopoly system broken. And that would, I don't know if it would take, I mean, I don't see how the Supreme Court could do it. You'd have to overturn laws in every state in this country.
Mm-hmm.
But this has been a year, an election year, when the need for a third party is so glaringly obvious. Mm-hmm. We have to have some kind of competition to this two-party system. There's this whole, I mean, one thing that the Sanders and Trump revolts have shown us is that there is a whole constellation of issues that the two major parties have been complicit in ignoring. You know, all of these economic issues having to do with the declining middle class. The two parties, it's very comfortable for them to both ignore it for reasons of their own, you know. But they're basically both parties are serve certain very wealthy constituents. You know, it's not just the Koch brothers and everything, it's a liberalism of the rich too. It's not just a conservatism of the rich, it's a liberalism of the rich. And
well, that's true, and I think the difference is, though, that liberal billionaires are, let's face it, all billionaires have massive egos, but it seems like right-wing billionaires, you know, just the bottom line, we'll give you the money and these are the results we expect. On the liberal side, you know, it's everybody has their sort of issues. You know, it's like part of the kind of liberal trap of identity politics, and you got to romance them forever and a day, and, you know, and you're not likely to get a check at the end of the day, whereas, you know, some guy, you know, makes a few million selling Chevrolets in the middle of Alaska, he's willing to write a big check to somebody who's going to maintain his right to assault rifles, etc., you know?
Yeah.
There's a disparity. They keep talking about, on the right, they always say, well, you've got George Soros and all these people, but try getting money out of George Soros.
Well, I mean, obviously, he's. I wasn't thinking of liberal billionaires. I was thinking of the top sort of 10% of the population. You know, we talk about inequality and, you know, how the top 1% has done really well and the top 0.1% has done really well. But the truth of the matter is that there is a mass constituency for inequality. It's not just the 1%. There is a mass constituency for inequality. There's a lot of people who've done very well with inequality, and it's the top 10%. And by and large, these people are Democrats. They are, the top of their of the professional class. They've done very well. You know, I'll give you an example. I live here in Montgomery County, Maryland. It's one of the richest counties in America. We're having a primary right now for a seat in Congress. All the candidates that I know of are Democrats. I don't even know if there's going to be a Republican who runs for the position. And it's shaping up to be the most expensive House race of all time, just the Democratic primary, because it's, you know, liberal billionaire facing liberal billionaire facing liberal billionaire. They all want that seat so badly. And that's Montgomery County. It is a liberalism of the rich. And these, by the way, these are people who are very satisfied with American politics the way they are, very happy with the way Obama has done things.
Sure.
They're very pleased with the Democratic Party.
Well, maybe it seems to have all started in a way with Michael Huffington, and who was pushed by his wife Arianna to become a congressman, and then 2 years later a senator. It's all about celebrity and not about results. And of course, they don't work. This is the thing that, I mean, Teddy Kennedy, in one of the last interviews he did on NPR, was asked, what has changed the most in your long tenure in the United States Senate? And he said, the worst thing that's happened is that nobody works anymore, because you come in on a Wednesday or a Tuesday night after spending the weekend and raising funds back in the district. And then you maybe work on Wednesday, and then Thursday you fly out of town and spend the next few days over the weekend raising funds again. And
that's right. They do it constantly. Yeah. They have a little special room they go to. They aren't allowed to do it from the Capitol proper, you know. Right. So they have to go to a little special room where they dial for dollars.
Right. Well, so our legislators have become telemarketers. That's the situation.
That
we have. But I'm looking for some optimism or hope. I'm not trying to be Pollyanna here, but I do think that, as you were talking earlier about the Sanders phenomenon and the Trump phenomenon, the biggest constituency, again, in American politics are independents. So is there some hope in organizing independents?
Yeah, well, the Sanders phenomenon does give me hope. Like I was saying before, there's going to be another Sanders, and he has shown that it is possible to challenge a powerful establishment candidate with fundraising from average people, and he even beat her in a number of primaries. It's kind of astonishing. You know, she's one of the best known figures of them all, and that's really extraordinary. And it can keep happening. Look, it doesn't. You just have to look back in history. Democrats were routinely, in the old days, routinely outspent by Republicans in a kind of, enormous way, 10-1, that kind of thing. And they still won. They won all the time, because that didn't really matter. They were a party that spoke to, the vast majority of the American public, the working class. Once they gave that up, though, then it does just become a matter of, out fundraising one another.
But what happened, and you made this clear in your book too, Thomas Frank, Listen Liberal, or whatever happened to the Party of the People, concurrent with that change, of course, was the destruction and downsizing of the union movement, because they've always been the piggy bank for the Democrats, and now rich liberals out here in California are the piggy bank for the Democrats.
That's right. That's how they refer to Hollywood, right? It's the Democratic Party ATM.
Right.
They just show up and make a big withdrawal.
Right, but you got to at least give George Clooney credit for saying that they raise an obscene amount of money, and that he completely agrees with Bernie Sanders, even though all the money went to Hillary Clinton.
I know, isn't that crazy? By the way, the unions still do give an enormous amount of money to the Democrats. It's just they don't get anything for their money. It's you really feel terrible for these guys because they're among the most, or at least their leadership is among the most loyal Democratic constituencies of them all, and they get nothing. The Democrats get into office and immediately turn around and ignore these guys. You know, they want card check or something like that. They never get it. It's they're treated very poorly.
Well, just in the last minute or so, then Thomas Frank, in terms of your new book, Listen Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People, we know that the system is rigged. That getting a third party is kind of a fool's errand, and more often than not, you end up with spoilers like Ralph Nader was in 2000 in Florida. So what is the path forward? My sense has always been that given the way the system is, if a bunch of right-wing crackpots, the Tea Party, can take over the Republican Party and become the tail that wags the dog of the Republican Party, why can't a bunch of highly motivated progressives, the kind of people flocking around Bernie Sanders, particularly the young people, why can't they take over the Democratic Party?
They absolutely can. By the way, that's another message of hope that I had forgotten about. What's the matter with Kansas, which was a very, sort of a dark book, it did tell the story of a popular grassroots uprising within the Republican Party. It's an uprising that, in my opinion, took that state in exactly the wrong direction. But it was still a popular uprising. You know, a lot of average people, not wealthy people, but average people, basically stealing the local Republican Party away from the sort of suburban moderate types who used to control it when I was growing up, and it's like a proletarian uprising going in entirely the wrong direction, but it did happen, and things like this still happen all the time, even though this is, of course, the land of big money. There is a million ways to play this game, and it is still a democracy. And what you just said is exactly right. Progressives can do the same thing.
Well, Thomas Frank, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It was my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Thomas Frank, who's the author of The Wrecking Crew, What's the Matter with Kansas, One Market Under God, and Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Time Swindle and Unlikely Comeback of the Right. He's a former opinion columnist for The Wall Street Journal and the founding editor of The Baffler and a monthly columnist for Harper's. And his latest book just out is Listen Liberal or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared by half.